This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com, and you can search for us on social media, searching for DogWorks Radio as well. Alex is calling in from Southern California. Alex, how's it going?
It is going great. We are experiencing a very, very wet winter, but we've been in drought down here for so long that no one is really complaining, as long as you're not in, you know, in the path of that dam that failed up near Sacramento.
Man, I heard about that. You know, up here, we are in the midst of a warm-up. It was 46 degrees here yesterday in Willow, so we've received quite a bit of melt, and I think that they're probably happy about changing that decision to move to Fairbanks for Iditarod. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was a strange kind of thing because everyone had said, well, there's so much snow around Anchorage and around Willow, which is true, or at least was true until the warm-up. But the problem was down by the Dalzell Gorge. There was just not very much snow. And I think the Iditarod wisely is looking to avoid a repeat of, I believe it was 2014, when they, you know, when there was just so little snow there. So we are back to the Fairbanks start route with the loop up by Hooslea that they ran in 2015. I believe it is exactly the same course as 2015, although there might be minor variations. So it should be a different but equally exciting race.
And if you remember, Alex, it was quite cold on that route last year. I believe minus 60 degrees in some portions of the trail. So it's definitely not an easier route going that way, is it?
No. And, you know, we like to say that there are challenges to any kind of route, whether it's the normal southern route, the normal northern route, or this this kind of hybrid Fairbanks route, which goes along a lot of the route of the 1925 Serum Run. So, you know, no matter what, it's certainly nothing that you would categorize as easy.
Right. And, you know, Alex, the preparations for Iditarod are well underway. A lot of the teams are getting their mandatory EKGs for all of their dogs, getting the blood work done. There's lots of pictures over on the Iditarod pages and on Iditarod.com, as well as a lot of the kennel pages. And the food drops are starting to come on in. I just saw, just before we went on the air, that Cindy Abbott took hers over to get dropped off over at Iditarod or wherever they dropped that off there. She had 1,700 pounds of food and supplies to ship out, and that will occur over the next week or so. And I know you know, Alex, but I bet a lot of listeners don't know that they have to pay for all of that to be shipped out. And I believe they get a 500-pound credit or something like that in regards to their entry fee, but the rest is coming out of the musher's pocket. Is that right?
Yeah, and so there's a balance that mushers have to evaluate, because you don't want to have too little food or not have enough provisions either for yourself or the dogs. But on the other hand, you also don't want to go crazy packing everything you could potentially need, because A, you're paying for it, and B, you're going to either have to drag it along with you on the trail or make a decision at the checkpoint to send it back. And I believe when they ship personal belongings back, they have to pay for that as well, although I'm positive about that.
Yeah, I believe that is the truth. I would love to have that as a topic of our next show, what goes into the drop bags and that whole logistics in doing that. I think that would be a great show that we haven't discussed before. You know, 1,700 pounds for Cindy is a pretty typical amount for most mushers. I have a friend of mine who I believe she holds the record for the pounds and drop bags, well over 2,500 pounds. So anywhere between 1,500 to 2,500 is about that right number in terms of pounds. That's a heck of a lot of dog food, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an enormous amount of dog food. Well, we can discuss it next time, what all goes in there. But you're right that somewhere around the figures I've heard mostly for people, the sort of average amount is about 1,600, 1,800 pounds, somewhere in there. So she's right in there with the amount you would expect to have.
And up between now and that first Saturday of March, when they do the ceremonial start in Anchorage, and then they're going to travel up the Parks Highway about 300 miles or so to start in Fairbanks, which will be on Monday. It will not be on Sunday like it is when it starts in Willow. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's going on in between now and then. All of the volunteers will start showing up. The banquet's going to be happening. The vet checks are happening. They just shipped out all of the straw and all the fuel for the cookers that are available to all of the mushers on the checkpoint. So things are well underway, and everybody was just in that holding pattern until they made that announcement on the 10th. Is that right?
Yeah, and, you know, there as we get closer to the start, there will be more and more things happening. The infrastructure for the communications will go into the remote checkpoints that don't normally have these things set up. So the telecom and all of the Wi-Fi and all of the stuff that the race officials and the media need to cover the race will be going in. And then we'll have trail breakers going ahead on snow machine, you know, starting, I guess, probably starting about 4 or 5 days before the start of the race in earnest, and they may have even started going through and doing some preliminary work as early as now.
Right. So let's jump over to the other 1,000-mile race. It is still going on right now. It looks like eight people are across the finish line in the Yukon Quest. Matt Hall, Hugh Neff, Alan Moore, Paige Dronby, Ed Hopkins, Thorsten Kohnert, I believe is how you pronounce it, Catherine Keith, and Jesse Royer. What do you think about Matt Hall? Man, he'd had a heck of a race, didn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, both of us were dead wrong in picking the winner. We both, about a week ago, thought that Brent Sass was going to win. And he scratched, which we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, Matt Hall is just, he's a second-generation competitive musher, grew up in the middle of nowhere, and just really is someone who I expected him to do well. I didn't expect him to win the race, but he just ran a really, really good race, boldly chose to go ahead of Brent when everyone was thinking that Brent kind of had it locked up. And then even at the halfway point, Brent was, I believe there was only like a 3-hour difference. And you know, it certainly is an unexpected thing. But I have to say, whenever someone like this wins a big race like the Yukon Quest, it just bodes well for the future. You know, this is someone who I would imagine is going to be very, very competitive for quite some time on these longer races like the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, he has been coming up in the ranks here recently in the past couple of years. He did very well in some of the shorter distance, mid-distance races in the Copper Basin and some of the others. So he is definitely going to be a force and to be reckoned with out on the Yukon Quest Trail. I'm not sure if he's doing Iditarod. We'll check that out. But then we have a couple of grizzled old veterans. They're typically battling it out for one of those top spots with Hugh Neff and Alan Moore. Hugh was the champion last year. And then he and Alan, boy, they've been battling it out for years for those first spots there. Hugh finished about 7 hours behind Matt, and then Alan finished about 2 hours behind Hugh. And then the first woman in, Paige Dronby, finished about 4 hours behind Alan. And then we have Ed Hopkins and then Thorsten. And then I was not surprised at Catherine Keith. We talked about her on our last show. She is definitely going to be the rookie of the year. She finished this morning at 11:48 a.m., just a few hours ahead of another woman, Jesse Royer. What do you think about the ladies in the top 10 here?
You know, I was I'm always very, very happy when the ladies do well. I had thought there was a chance that Paige might actually have won this race, but certainly finishing fourth in a 1,000-mile race is nothing to sneeze about. She just ran a really, really great race, and is one of these. We talk a lot about how there's a group of mushers, a group of teams in any race that conceivably could win given, the right combination of weather and luck and dog health and, a bunch of sort of things that you can't control all that well. And I think Paige Drobny and Alan and Hugh are definitely people who, with a little bit of a different circumstance, any one of them could have won this race.
And you know what I like seeing, Alex, is the number of dogs in or the number of dogs that finished. Matt with 10, Hugh with 11, Alan with 12, Paige with 11, Ed with 10, Thorsten with 11, Catherine with 10, Jesse Royer with 12, and then we should have Ryan Olson crossing over the finish line relatively soon. She's on her way in from Two Rivers. She left at 3 o'clock this morning, and it takes about 12 hours or so, what they're saying, to run that last leg. Looks like she will have 10 dogs as well on the line. That bodes well to the race, and I think we can talk a little bit about drop dogs in a second when we talk about some of these guys that scratched. But I think that's doing very well in terms of dog management. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how many dogs come in is always something that I think is a little bit mystifying for fans, because on the one hand, you look at a team that can finish with all of their dogs or nearly all of their dogs, and that's certainly a great accomplishment. But on the other hand, sometimes things happen to dogs, and there's no shame in dropping a dog if the dog is not doing well or just not having a good time, because as we like to talk about a lot, especially with people who are running younger teams, the goal isn't necessarily to win or to finish as high as possible, although you certainly would like that, but the goal is really to give these dogs a great experience so that the next year, when they're running a similar race or the same race, they will be excited and they will hopefully do even better because they'll have the memory of what a great experience it was to run the first time. So, it's a tricky thing because when you have a lot of dogs, it means that your planning for which dogs to take was good, as well as the what happened on the race itself and how you were able to adjust to that while you were out on the trail.
And just speaking from more experience, just by following the race for many years in terms of Iditarod, it's difficult to finish with a string of 16 dogs. I don't think very many people have done it in recent history. I'm thinking back to Jake Berkowitz in recent times was the one that finished with a full string of 16. And then you have folks like Dallas who it's part of his strategy to finish with a much smaller team. He keeps the strongest dogs on the line at the end, and that's part of his strategy because he I believe he calls it building the monster, and he does that by being very selective on what dogs he keeps and what dog he drops, and it becomes part of that machine that he is trying to get across that finish line. Do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, you're exactly right, but also in Iditarod, there are several different distinct parts of the course, and the last part of the course where you are up on the Bering Sea, you need a different type of dog to do really well in that part of the course. It's relatively flat. There are some hills, but it's relatively flat, certainly compared to the early part of the course. There is sometimes a lot of wind, so there are sometimes are weather factors, but you're really looking for a dog that can just flat-out run more than a dog that has a lot of power for climbing hills.
Right, and you're not necessarily gaining a lot of speed by an extra two or four dogs on the team. You're adding power, but you're not necessarily adding speed, because you are, as the old mantra goes, you're as fast as your slowest dog. So you're not going to add a tremendous amount of horsepower, so to speak, by keeping a lot of dogs there. And of course, the less dogs on your team, the easier it is to manage. You can take care of eight dogs much easier than you can 12, 14, or 16. And I think that's also part of Dallas's strategy.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly up until now, that strategy has worked incredibly well for him. There may come a year where it doesn't work at all, and where, you know, and we're dropping teams and having a much smaller group of dogs on the coast would mess him up. But at least so far, he has anticipated things almost perfectly, and that's why he's done so well in the past 4 or 5 years.
All right, Alex, let's switch gears a little bit. We're still going to talk about the Quest here, but boy, in the last few days, has social media just been in an uproar with back and forth commentary about the reporting, the lack of reporting, the decisions on the Quest, all sorts of quote-unquote armchair drama is going on. What are your thoughts on that as a fan, and how should fans, especially newbie fans, take some of the things that they're reading?
Well, you know, my first thought is that I actually love that these conversations are happening. A few years ago, it was much harder to have conversations like this. There were a few of them that happened, but people tended to get shut down when they started trying to even raise these issues. As a newbie and as someone who is not out there on the runners with a team of dogs, I think there is always a danger that you say, well, this person did something wrong, and that you make judgments as someone who's not out there. I always try to avoid doing that and to give the mushers and the race officials the benefit of doubt. But I like that there are these discussions going on, and I like that some of the more experienced mushers have been weighing in on this as well, even though they've been, for the most part, you know, rather diplomatic about their criticism, but at least they are weighing in. And I'm talking about people like Sebastian Schnulli, who has weighed in a lot in this Yukon Quest.
So, you know, we've talked about it on the show several times on how we compare and contrast with other sports. And the way I see this, it's a lot like football. And for folks that watch the NFL on TV, there is somebody's job sitting in that booth that is doing exactly what's happening right now, you know, at what they're calling themselves as armchair mushers. There is a color analyst. That person is giving his opinion or his insight based on the game, where on the other side of the booth is the sort of the play-by-play. It's an entirely different dynamic from one person to the other. And I think that's what we're seeing here is really strong color analysis or color commentary about sort of the intricacies of the sport versus who's winning, who's losing, you know, sort of the black and white X's and O's type of analysis. Do you think that that's needed here, or do you think that we should just have more cut and dry? Because Facebook is changing the way that mushing is being covered and being watched, I guess you could say, and sort of understood, especially from folks that don't have, you know, a firsthand knowledge of the sport, you know, whether they're not mushers or they haven't been around sled dogs, they're just purely fans.
Yeah, you are exactly right. And in my mind, it's a good thing, but it has its dangers. It has its potential, you know, it has its potential downside. I love the fact that, especially the past couple of years, we've been getting a lot more analysis from people who have run long-distance races, about things like run rest cycles and, you know, whether what it means if you're making a run early in between two checkpoints, maybe as two runs with a rest or as three runs with two rests. I think that gives really just a dimension to the sport that was a lot harder to get a few years ago. You know, that's coupled with having trackers on all of the sleds in almost all of the major races these days. So you can get a wealth of information that was a lot harder to get in the past. So you can see where someone is stopping. You can see things like, you know, how long their rests are, what their speed is, their average speed when they're actually running, as opposed to just an average overall that includes rests. So I think that there's an opportunity to really learn a lot more about what's going on. Now, the drawback to that is that you can find yourself, as people have in this Yukon Quest, looking, for example, at Hank de Bruin's team and saying, well, he's going very, very slowly. And I think there was an expectation that he was going to scratch, and then he kept going, and he was at one point, I think before he scratched, well over 100 miles behind the next team. And there were several people who said, well, this is not good, because the race officials have to stay and man the checkpoints, and it's really becoming kind of a drag on the race.
Right. So I have two questions for you here to end our show in regards to this, Alex. The first question is, do you think that this is a fair and balanced analysis or color commentary from these folks? Folks are either taking it as a positive or as a negative, and they can either be praised for it or the old adage, killing the messenger, so to speak. So that's the first question. Do you think it's fair and balanced coverage from these folks? And the second question is, what is your style in this? What are you trying to do on our show? Are you trying to do your own analysis from a fan's perspective? Are you trying to tell stories? What is your job on this show? Because I don't think that's really ever been defined, and we don't want to pigeonhole ourselves into being something that we're not.
Yeah, you know, it's those are both great questions. I think that it has mostly been relatively fair, maybe not as balanced as it could be. There certainly are some people who go to one extreme or the other. You know, for example, with the sort of controversy about Brent Sass perhaps pushing his dogs too hard, and then, you know, having to push the button on the tracker, and then being offered the opportunity to keep going but with a penalty. That's been, I think, the most controversial part of the quest. I've seen a lot of people saying, "Oh, this is great that Brent was acting in the best interest of his dogs," and there also have been several other relatively high-profile people saying, "This is crazy. He got himself into trouble for pushing his dogs too hard." I don't know myself what the answer is, and I suspect pretty much Brent is probably the only person who knows that for sure. I do know that it feels better to have all of those voices chiming in, even if I'm not quite sure how much credence to put on any one of them.
Right.
And as for my role, I tend to see myself as someone who is primarily interested in the stories. And then someone who just tries to absorb as much of this as possible, hopefully getting more knowledgeable as time goes on. I certainly think back to how much I knew about dog racing 4 or 5 years ago, and I feel like I know an enormous amount now compared to then. But even now, I'm so aware of how much I don't know. So I'm very careful as someone who is not a musher not to assume that I understand everything that's going on or that I know what people are doing right and wrong.
You know, I agree with you there. My role on this show is to give a musher's perspective, at least from my experience. I have not ran Iditarod, nor have I ran the Quest, but I have quite a few years of mushing experience, at least to offer some insight there. But I agree with you. I do this a lot for the stories. I think there are so many stories to be told, especially about folks that people don't know a lot about. And we often talk about those middle to the back of the packers when we do our Iditarod coverage. So that's at least my role. And you know, we've just sort of taken it for granted here on the show on how we present it. But before we go, Alex, I have to give a little bit of a congratulations to both of us. Did you know on the 29th of February, it will be our 5-year anniversary of being here on KVRF here in Palmer? I had no idea you and I were hosting this show that long here on the radio. What do you think about that?
Wow, that's kind of great. I think that's amazing. And, you know, certainly a little bit of praise goes to us. I think a lot of praise goes to the radio station for having a show like this on. You for starting Mushing Radio on Blog Talk all those years ago. And you know, for everyone who listens, I have to say I really, really appreciate it. I know we both do. And it's something.
It is. You know, it's a blessing and a curse, I guess, for being on Facebook. You know how they have those daily Facebook memories pop up, and that popped up this morning that said that we went on the air here on the radio for the first time on February 29th. So I thought that was pretty cool. We've had a lot of shows. We've did a lot of Iditarod coverage over the years. We've had a lot of fans come up and give comments and praise and all sorts of things from all over the world. So we do have to thank them for that as well. So, Alex, we only have about 30 seconds before we go. I definitely want to talk about the drop bags. Next time, we will be really close to Iditarod the next time we're on. Anything you want to say in closing?
You know, just keep watching these races. They are really fascinating. Follow mushers, follow kennels on Facebook. There's just so much information out there right now, and it's a lot easier than it was 5 years ago.
There you go. So on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys next time.